Salman Khan, thanks very much for agreeing to be part of Radio Regent News and Views. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here, and looking forward to having our discussion.
Excellent. So I was put in touch with you through Justice for Migrant Workers, of course, an advocacy organization for migrant workers in the country, especially in Ontario, where we see so many human rights abuses really going on constantly for decades now. And I know that you have done a little bit of work with Justice for Migrant Workers, organizing events. Can you just talk briefly about your academic work and the connections it would have to thinking about the rights of migrant workers in the country?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's definitely an overlap. So my research mostly is currently focusing on questions of racial capitalism. And so looking at the ways in which race and racism have historically been linked with capitalism, you know, as opposed to seeing the two phenomena as distinct, or, you know, taking the more conventional approach of seeing capitalism as strictly this sort of economic system that, you know, has ideologies such as race or gender secondary to it. So what my work aspires to argue, building off of the work of writers such as the late Cedric Robinson, is that something like racism is, you know, part and parcel of the economic, the structure of the economic system, maybe in terms of the way the labor system is organized, thinking about imperialism, colonialism, the history of labor exploitation in the global south as, you know, sort of concretely linked into the system rather than a sort of aberrations or, you know, moments of capitalism that sort of predate modernity or, you know, slavery as, for example, is something that is, you know, just this element of primitive accumulation that is not something integral to the system. So basically what something like racial capitalism is arguing is that none of these experiences are in the past or secondary or things that are not central to, say, any kind of, you know, revolutionary politics or anti-capitalist politics or, you know, sort of a politics that really tries to take aim and attention to the system that we live in. And, you know, bringing it back to the topic of migrant workers, we see the whole phenomena of temporary foreign migrant workers, you know, of workers from the global south going to really these nations such as in North America, Canada, the U.S., Europe, as really indicative of this system, this global system of racial capitalism. Right, so where you have a sort of racialized migrant working force that is, you know, unduly exploited, that's relied on as a pool of sort of cheap labor, that does not have the same rights as other workers. And you see sort of the more intensified forms of exploitation that these workers face under the system of capitalism. And so when you look at what's going on with migrant workers, whether working in the agricultural industry or as domestic workers or in frontline services, is really this uneven system of exploitation that's rooted in the system. And so, I mean, part of seeing it this way is then, you know, sort of a demand for the centrality of these questions in any kind of, you know, radical politics. Gives more precedence to it. It gives more importance to it. When we talk about workers' movements, when we talk about workers' rights, when we talk about organizing workers, these experiences of migrant workers are up there, right, front and center with all the other workers. And so, yeah, it's, you know, just as a little intro, that it's sort of a way of tying all of these together, but I'm sure we can clarify things a bit more as we continue talking.
It's fascinating. So one of the things that I gleaned from what you just said that's very interesting is that the kind of the racialization of capitalism, that racism is intrinsic to the very structure of capitalism. It's essential to it, as opposed to something incidental or, oh, it's a shame that all this racism takes place in our society, but it's separate from the economic model. What you're saying is that racialization and victimization in this way is actually part and parcel of the economic system.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the term racial capitalism itself is coined by Cedric Robinson, and, you know, he's really developing that term, which originated in apartheid South Africa, mm-hmm. as a means of sort of coming to terms with what that system was. And, you know, he's done really good historical work looking at sort of the origins of contemporary or modern-day capitalism as it exists today in Europe in, say, the 17th century. And, you know, what he really finds is that rather than capitalism emerging as this sort of force that was a, you know, to use the technical term, negation of all that existed before it, right? So if the all kinds of feudal or idyllic or racial hierarchies, capitalism emerges based on these very cultural, racial foundations. So even from its inception, you really see, you know, existing forms of hierarchy and racialism within Europe that separated Europeans themselves along various bloodlines, forms of xenophobia, nationalism, really inform what capitalism looked like and looks like. And so these existing racialisms that, you know, fed into the system, that shaped the system of capitalism, then, you know, translate even further and come to shape, organize the exploitation of racialized people in the global south, you know, through, as we know, the expansion of colonialism, European powers. And so in Robinson's text, for example, Black Marxism, he provides this rich history, this rich background that isn't really taken up by writers and theorists, you know, in not just the theory of the tradition of Marxism, but, you know, in any kind of school or understanding or writing around the relation between capitalism and racism. And so it provides a, you know, a very unique, very telling model to inform our politics today, just in terms of where we apply importance.
Sorry, were you going to continue?
No.
It's very interesting. You talk about capitalism as being intrinsically linked to racism and racialized ideas. And yet capitalism is seen as this kind of almost panacea to these, as you said, older forms of economic systems. It's almost like, oh, well, capitalism is sort of democratizes it all because it's about, you know, people, everyone having the same access to economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. We're post-racial or whatever it is, even in the 1800s when the Industrial Revolution made capitalism the economic system of the day. And yet slavery was still going on, and it was intrinsic to at least American society, if not Canadian society as well. So my question is, how much is subterfuge, how much is a kind of distorted ideology necessary to all of this? I'm thinking about the fact that I've known South Africans who lived during apartheid, and they, white South Africans, and they said they didn't know where the township were. I'm thinking of the fact that Canadians right now, white Canadians, privileged Canadians, are completely ignorant about what's going on with migrant workers. It's almost like this distortion of reality is intrinsic to capitalism as well. That's what allows it to keep going. Do you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that definitely plays a role. And, you know, like even just speaking about ideology, I think something like racism has solely been focused as just an ideology, as something ideological, rather than as something very material and very concrete. And that comes out of that sort of politics that sees it as sort of, you know, not intrinsic to the system. It's something secondary. And then, you know, you get theories about racism as just this sort of, cunning way of dividing workers, propagated through the media or, you know, distortions through history. And, you know, while all of that is true, it in some ways ignores how, you know, to again lean heavily on Robinson's work, how something like racism, you know, is very real and very material in the way that the society organizes itself, you know. So there's a very real way, and as you said, in the experience in South Africa, people didn't know, white South Africans didn't know where the townships were. And if you even look at that one example, you see how the arrangement of living quarters, the living conditions, physically separate people.
Mm.
And we see that even in the city of Toronto, where neighborhoods are very segregated, as if it was, and it is in very many ways, an apartheid city. And so we begin to see this sort of racial blindness as more than simply just an ideology, as a way that the society is actually structured that keeps people blind to the realities that other people are facing, to the forms of marginalization and exploitation that people are facing. And it's even clearer more than ever now that we're going through COVID.
Mm.
You know, it really surprised me how when, you know, earlier in this year, sort of COVID was really taking off and there was a lot of talk about, you know, we're all in this together and we really support our frontline workers. And there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, sort of higher paid frontline professions. Doctors, health workers.
Mm.
But you never see any attention being paid on, you know, the frontline workers that are in the grocery stores, the workers that are working in transportation that now more than ever we rely on. People don't want to leave their houses. They just have to make some kind of order online, and their food or anything gets delivered to them. And it's sort of this invisible workforce that people either willingly or unwillingly fail to pay attention to or see. But that's really keeping the society alive.
But I would go even further, and I'd say that on a certain level, a bus driver in Toronto is visible, literally. Whereas migrant workers stuck on these farms during COVID-19 with you know, it's completely impossible for them to have social distancing. There's outbreaks among migrant workers because of this. Migrant workers really are invisible. I mean, people just, you know, when I say people, I mean, you know, mostly white or, you know, privileged Torontonians, say, privileged Canadians, don't know migrant workers exist. Or if they exist, if they know they exist, they don't know how ridiculous the conditions are. So it's almost like there's another level of invisibility when it comes to migrant workers.
Right. No, definitely. I mean, there's the complexity of layers is, it's intense.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the first things then that this forces us to do is, you know, even with the specific example of migrant workers, is really rethink the way we envision social movements or the demands in social movements.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking particularly of sort of the way revolutionary politics are framed, or what kind of language we're using, or whose experiences we're taking into account. And, you know, it's in one way, and ambitious to try and, you know, construct this meta-narrative of society and, you know, claim to speak for workers in general and then put forward these demands. And, you know, we see that in classic forms of, you know, anti-capitalist politics or even sort of social democratic politics. But I think a first step in really trying to break this barrier of invisibility is coming to terms with the fact that society is complex. There's many experiences that we aren't clear to, that aren't so fully visible, that are usually hidden. And, you know, to me, that sort of is the place to begin and is almost the definition of grassroots. And so I know I'm taking this into a whole different direction right now, but even just for this example of migrant workers,
yeah,
you know, what can we do to really build a radical politics, a grassroots politics that begins, that starts with workers, with people in the society that we don't see, whose experiences are invisible. And I think that it's slower than what we like to think revolutionary politics should be, but I think that sort of on-the-ground grassroots organizing is what's going to bring that visibility up, is what's going to start shedding light on these experiences, on the experiences of these workers, is going to literally, you know, almost cultivate a culture that includes them in our politics, their rights, their needs, their demands.
So you're talking about a holistic kind of slow-paced revolution of thought that involves everyone, not just the migrant workers, not just workers who are marginalized, but everyone? Is that sort of where you're getting a kind of new consciousness-raising movement?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the term that's usually used is, you know, raising a critical consciousness.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I guess the question I'm posing is, what will it really take to get people to take seriously the experiences of migrant workers or any frontline workers that we don't usually, see when we're engaging or talking in these politics? You know, I'm just going to use the example of, say, what can be more broadly talked about as working class politics or left politics.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the program and, you know, raising consciousness of workers is really, you know, talking about workers in a very broad brush. Or usually it's the concerns of unionized workers, or it's, you know, workers that are in more conventional professions that we consider as, you know, under the umbrella of full-time paid work. And so if we're really trying to get people to be more aware, not aware in just simply knowing, oh, something like the temporary migrant foreign worker program exists, but really to consciously be aware in a way that they implicate themselves.
Yeah.
In the experiences of migrant workers. Really, what is that going to take? And I think the only way of raising consciousness in that way, of tapping into that potential of all of us, is really through this grassroots approach and beginning with migrant workers themselves. I know this can sound very abstract, as I'm saying it, but, you know, like, you posed a very interesting question. Like, what will it actually take people to see, to understand? Because to a certain degree, this information is out there. People are aware in some sense that something like the migrant worker program exists. A lot of work has been done in bringing their experiences to light. But it's still not central to our politics.
Well, because everyone likes cheap food.
Right.
You need to have something that causes discomfort, or you need something that really hits home the fact that Canada that has this kind of image of being a bastion of human rights and, you know, this liberal society, that Canada has this, I'll use the term, underbelly of human rights abuse that's been going on since the 1960s at least when it comes to our migrant worker program. And, you know, I'm not sure how knowledgeable people are about this. I would argue perhaps that this ignorance, this willful ignorance, is intrinsic to our food system. It would be too disruptive in terms of profits, in terms of food prices, to change anything. And so there's a kind of, again, willful sort of almost drug effect that takes over. And it's very hard to break through that.
Right. And, I mean, you see this, you know, also in the example of the campaign to raise the minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a particular demand that really caught traction in the mainstream. But the strange thing was that the way that narrative was twisted and turned, and how polarized support was for raising the minimum wage among workers themselves. To some extent, I feel like people were aware that part of keeping the minimum wage down was the access to cheap food.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's an interesting way that I think us as activists have to begin thinking about, not begin because it's always there, but how to get people to identify with others. Right. And I feel like a lot of the times, historically, anti-capitalist politics, for example, has really, really relied on this idea that capitalism is a very homogenizing force. And, you know, we're all in this boat as exploitable free wage labor. And so, you know, somehow there are these conditions that are created for us to really share interests. Because now we're all workers, and so for the first time in human history, we can identify ourselves with each other. And the reality of it is, especially when we take seriously something like racial capitalism, is that that's not true.
No.
We don't have the material conditions that are actually creating some kind of sense of universality where we're all sort of in the same boat. The reality of it is some of us are in bigger boats, some in smaller, some aren't even in boats. And so it's forcing us to really think seriously about what do we have in our capacity to identify in solidarity with other workers whose exploitation we ourselves benefited off of. And I think, you know, there's no easy answer to it, but the good thing about critiquing and problematizing in this way is it actually is forcing us to really take these questions seriously. Because it's not so easy, you know, to sort of say, well, we're all workers and so this is happening and, you know, to these workers and let's just, you know, unite with each other.
Yeah, it's not that simple, yeah.
Yeah, it's much more complex than, you know, writers such as Marx in his day were, you know, realities that they were exposed to or willfully ignoring.
Yeah, workers of the world unite and all that. Just one more question, and it might be a big answer, it might not. So you're a wonderful ally for people to have because you're both an accomplished academic, you're a PhD student at York. And you're also an activist. You're both, which is this wonderful thing. In terms of just brass tacks, and I know that you've done organizing around migrant workers in the past through Justice for Migrant Workers. What would you, if there was like a step one, the first thing that you would suggest, not in terms of how do I say this? Not in terms of concepts of raising consciousness at a slow pace, but if people were to be active, say, tomorrow in support of migrant workers, what is something that could be done? What is something that you would organize or that you would suggest that people organize right now?
I mean, there's no easy answer to that. You know, I feel like the difficulty is that for a long time we have been looking for that, that answer, you know, and in many ways in trying to give that answer, we have shortchanged the reality. And so I think more than anything, though, what would be necessary is, you know, really looking at the situation that we're in the current moment, right? And what is really, you know, what is really going on around us and what can we tap into?
When you say do you mean in terms of COVID-19 or?
COVID-19.
Yeah.
For sure, you know, and I mean, yeah, that's just one example of, you know, how is COVID-19 exposing the inequalities that already existed? What are some, you know, concrete demands that can come out of the situation we're in, whether in terms of resources distributed by the government in response to COVID-19? Whether it's in terms of thinking about where do we go from here after COVID-19, if there is an after, you know, what sort of organizations are really coming to the fore in terms of organizing around the COVID. I think that is one direction to go into, but again, like I said, there is really no easy answer.
No.
I think we can plug into, you know, as individuals, organizations that are already doing work, that have been doing work for many years, you know, support them in ways that we can, educate ourselves, try to educate people around us.
Well, that strikes me. I mean, you know, maybe I'm sort of hopeless optimist. But when I tell people about interviews I've been doing for this segment, migrant workers, and I tell my friends, tell people in my life about the experiences of migrant workers, they're of course shocked because it's so abysmal, the conditions facing some of these people. And, you know, the migrant worker program in Canada has been going, I find it so amazing, it's been going on for decades and with no, and it's, I had an academic a few weeks ago saying it's gotten worse since the 1960s. People are shocked and ask, you know, what can I do? So my sense is if, and maybe again, I'm being idealist or I'm being silly or naive, but the more dissemination of information about this, the better. Just the sheer ignorance about it, and there's so many layers to break through in terms of getting the word out there. But am I being naive that the quickest way to any kind of change is to have a kind of much more of a mass understanding about how abysmal the conditions are? Because it just isn't there, it strikes me. People don't know.
No, I mean, I don't think you're being naive at all. There's never any downside to sharing more information. You know, the sort of more grotesque thing about our society is when this information gets out there, what kind of change is going to happen?
Well, yes, of course, yes.
And, you know, what are people willing to do individually and collectively to really step in and stand up and stand with people?
The cynic would say not very little or not very much. That would be, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm optimistic too. I do think people, or we in general collectively, have it in our capacity to do that. But of course, I think that really will require a sort of evolving, more dynamic, more critical, and more sort of open-ended politics, that can really sort of, not want to find that necessarily quick fix solution or, simplified sort of political answer, that it just will hope or seek to rally people around. Whether that means it's sort of a more long haul movement or change, who knows? But, we do see politics changing all the time. We do see movements emerging. We take, for example, even all the movements in the U.S. around Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
That's just an example of how if we really took something like race, seriously, as something so central to the system, people would look at that. People in labor organizations and unions and the socialist movement and see it as revolutionary politics, see it as politics that's really getting to the heart of the system, And maybe that's part of it in getting people to really rally around movements, organizations that maybe aren't necessarily speaking the same language as them or, coming from the same tradition or making the demands that they think are the most effective in changing the system. So there's almost this sort of wide-scale sort of education that is needed that, is maybe more than just information on what's going on, but, really, that really tries to get us to think differently about where sort of this revolutionary potential exists in our society. I'm really focusing on it this way because of my own work.
Mm-hmm.
Around racial capitalism, and so my emphasis or response would be towards, say, what is conventionally thought of as the workers' movement. I would see something like Black Lives Matter or organizing around the rights of migrant farm workers as working class movements, as movements central to the working class, central to critiquing and challenging capitalism.
Samad, thanks so much for this. It's been illuminating, fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Great talking with you, too.